This is a Stimulus Network podcast.
The Cosmic Shed.
Hello and welcome to The Cosmic Shed. I'm Andrew and we've got a bit of a swashbuckling episode for you today. I don't say that lightly. We've got animal rescue and we've got the discovery of a mountain right here on Earth, hitherto unknown by science. But you probably noticed something a little different at the start of this episode, and that's because I'm delighted to say that we have joined forces with Inside the Petri Dish, Eureka Nerd, and For What It's Earth to create the Stimulus Network, a network of podcasts. If you want to find out more about it, you can go to www.stimulus.network. I'm sure we'll tell you more about that another time, but let's get on with today's episode. And Russell Arnott, who you'll know from our advent calendar last year, recently went on a trip to Antarctica with the British Antarctic Survey.
All of us went to Punta Arenas, which is on the southern tip of Chile, and previously it was a whaling and sealing port, and now it's this gateway to Antarctica. So we all met there, and all the equipment got put on board. The whole cruise was a physics cruise, so looking at like turbulent mixing in the deep ocean to get an idea of like gas exchange between the ocean and the atmosphere, but to also get an idea of current flows in and out of these deep sea trenches. And water cools down in near Antarctica, sinks to the bottom and flows along the seabed before kind of flowing out into the rest of the world. It forms an important part of what's called the thermohaline circulation. Sometimes people call it the oceanic conveyor belt, and it takes about 1,000 years to go all the way around to the beginning, and it's just this flow of water that's caused by density differences. So they're trying to get a better understanding of why that happens. I guess the processes that drive that, in order so we can predict climate a little bit better. And we picked up Marina Costa, who is a marine mammal and wildlife surveyor with SARI. It's the South Atlantic Environmental Research Institute, and they're based on the Falkland Islands. And Marina is an expert in birds, seals, and whales and dolphins. And it just so happens that there's loads and loads of awesome dolphins that only live around the Falkland Islands and around the southern tip of Chile. We're on board the James Clark Ross, and we have just left Punta Arenas in Chile, and we've just spent the day passing through the Straits of Magellan, and we're heading to the Falkland Islands.
So my name is Marina Costa. So the idea is trying to identify some area that will be managed, ideally protected from human activity in the future. And I always, always wish to come to the Falkland to have a look of what there is, because in my experience, I always work in warm countries,
okay. So
basically Red Sea, Mediterranean Sea, Black Sea, a little bit in the North Sea in Scotland, but mainly was warm seas. And so when I had these opportunities, also working on these particular species that there are in the Falklands, who are these two crazy dolphins called Peel's dolphin and Commerson dolphins. Mm-hmm. I just applied the job and I got it.
So those two dolphins are endemic to the Falkland Islands?
So we can't really say endemic. So when the project was proposed, it was basically this dolphin has a particular restricted distribution. So basically they are present in the continental platform around the southern tip of South America. They extend until the Falkland, but we didn't know if there were a genetic relationship with the Patagonian one. So this was one of the aim of our project, trying to understand which were the genetic relationships. So if there was, genetic flow between the two groups or no. Yeah. Because the idea is that now that we collect all this data on dolphins and whales, and then we presented a draft for a new species action plan for cetacean for the islands. And it would be very nice to see these to become a reality in a more kind of structure protection of the marine environment around the Falkland.
So as we were going through the Straits of Magellan, it was awesome because we caught the tide. And so this giant boat, we were on board the James Clark Ross. We were going 20 knots through this strait with the tide, and all these dolphins were coming alongside the boat and using our bow wave to kind of swim along with us. and we saw these things. So they've got a lot of a species called Peel's dolphin, which are really nice little dolphins, black, white and grey patches. And then these ones called Commerson's dolphins, who are like the whitest white I've ever seen on an animal, with jet black. They look fake. They look like a remote control dolphin. And you just see them like out the corner of your eye in the water. And so Marina, so enthusiastic, she spent pretty much every hour that she possibly could. She'd get up at 5 a.m. She was on top of the bridge on an area of the boat called the Monkey Island, just there with her dictaphone, just recording stuff. We've seen a whale. There's this whale here. There's that whale here. And as we were coming into the Falkland Islands, we went through like a pod of 15 fin whales, and it was just like little geysers just erupting all over the place. And Marina was so excited, and she was like, "Oh, it's like, it's like a fin whale invasion." But, and so then we came into an area of the Falkland Islands called Mare Harbour, which is like, well, it's basically an RAF refuelling depot. Nearby, there was a place called Bertha's Beach. So we walked along Bertha's Beach, and it's called Bertha's Beach after this boat, the Bertha, that ran aground there. Because just off the coast of the beach, there's an island called, I think it's called Deception Island. And for some reason, it causes loads and loads of magnetic anomalies. And so it caused the ship's compass to go out, and they ran aground. Mm. So we walked along the beach, and there's these Peel's dolphins and Commerson's dolphins, like in the waves, catching fish. There's giant penguin colonies there, like Gentoo penguins and Magellanics and rockhoppers, I think. Yeah. Definitely Gentoo penguins. I'm not a penguin expert. And they just, you sit on the beach, and they just walk past you and go into the sea. I was very aware, like, okay, this is the last time I'm going to see land for 6 weeks. So I went for this big walk along the beach, and I had my GoPro on my head, and I was like, yeah, I've got my GoPro for Christmas, and I had time lapse. It was a really windy, blustery day, and but really sunny. And then I walk up over this kind of hill, and then I look down, and there's two of the people from the boat, like, messing around in the surf. And I'm like, what are they trying to get out of the water? So I walk down towards them, and then my GoPro goes as it runs out of battery. Oh. And then I'm like, what are you guys up to? And they're like, we found this dolphin up the beach. And they'd found a baby dolphin. Like, it must have been out of water for 4 hours or something like that, right off the high tide line. They thought it was dead. They nudged it, and it gave a noise. And they were like, quick, get it in the water. So they picked it up, put it in the waves, but it would, because it'd been out of water for so long, it was just really, really weak, and it was just getting rolled around in the waves and rolling up and down the beach. And I was like, oh, the baby dolphin. And without thinking, I took all my clothes off down to my pants. Oh, okay. And and carried the baby dolphin and held it next to me in the sea while it rejuvenated. And then I let it go. And it swam off, and then obviously decided it was still tired, and came back to me. Oh. I was like, oh my God, it's back! Amazing. And I just had to stand there in the quite cold water, holding this baby dolphin.
I think we've all got a mental image which we can live with for the rest of our lives. It's a bit, in my head, it's a bit like that, you know, the muscly guy cradling a baby poster.
Definitely not a muscly guy. Skinny white guy with little chicken wing arms, holding a thing that's basically feels like a big aubergine.
Right.
Yeah. You want to know what a dolphin feels like? Feels like an aubergine. Just hold an aubergine. You can recreate it.
So, when it comes back to you, did you kind of want to stay in the water forever and live with it?
Mm. It wasn't just like, you're a strange creature, let me go, or it felt threatened. The fact that it tried to go off, knew that it couldn't, but then that it was okay to come back for help, you really got this impression that, whoa, it was like a child, actually like a child would. Mm. So, yeah, it was incredible. It was quite, for me, without sounding like a big hippie, like, I love the dolphins. It was quite a profound wildlife experience for me, yeah.
That reminds me, just you saying that reminds me of the Martin Joseph song, I Don't Know Why, But Dolphins Make Me Cry.
Perhaps that's why, perhaps that's why, I see the dolphin, it makes me cry. As I look in your eyes, I look in your eyes.
But no, joking apart, it is a wonderful experience, and I'm jealous. On board, you watched some films.
We watched lots of films because it was quite stormy a lot of the time, so we couldn't do work. And they've got a full-on, they've got two DVD libraries and a full-on, like, electric hard drive full of everything, because you've got very limited bandwidth, so Netflix doesn't work on board the boat. Yeah. We watched Deadpool, we watched The Room, and obviously The Disaster Artist.
Really?
Yeah, so that was awesome, like in the middle of a Southern Ocean storm, sitting there watching Tommy Wiseau do his stuff. Yeah. So that was cool. We watched all kinds of things. Guardians of the Galaxy. I was making people watch a lot of rubbish films. We watched Virus, the 1999 Jamie Lee Curtis film about the robot alien on board a boat. Yeah. I was like, we need to watch this. And they were like, Russell, that was awful. I was like, I know, but that's the whole point. So this is Jen Jackson, and she is a marine biologist, specifically is a geneticist, but she studies whale populations in the Southern Ocean and to try and get an idea of numbers, their behaviour, and their migration patterns. So she's based on South Georgia at King Edward Point, which is the British Antarctic Survey research station there. It's about 15 people there. And she's been doing some great work trying to tag the various humpback whales that come past the island. We collected you from South Georgia, which I must admit, when coming in there, was breathtaking. It was like someone had put the Alps in the middle of the ocean. And you get to live there. So what is life like on South Georgia?
Oh, life on South Georgia, yep, it's very, very different. I mean, South Georgia was at the epicenter of modern whaling 100 years ago, and it was also heavily exploited by sealers in the 19th century. So it is now a place where, because of conservation measures and very careful management by the government down there, animals are really, really coming back in great numbers. They've eradicated rats, which were invasive, and now they have pipit populations. They have tons and tons of Antarctic fur seals. They have southern elephant seals. There are king penguins and gentoos and all kinds of animals living around us on the base down there. So we have to be very careful not to disturb the animals and to stay out of their way. But it's also just endlessly brilliant because you can look out the window and count 25 fur seals flat out on the grass having a snooze. We're down there to try and understand whale populations a bit better in South Georgia, because since they were heavily exploited nearly 100 years ago, there's very little known about how they're recovering, how they use South Georgia waters, where they are. So we're trying to use the base in Cumberland Bay in the centre of South Georgia to get out and, we're using small boats, find whales in that local area and tag them to understand where they're going and where they're feeding, and also collect small skin samples to understand their isotope chemistry, i.e. what they're feeding on, and to get genetic samples to ID individuals. And we're also collecting photos and trying to get everybody, all the cruise ships and fisheries vessels in the area, to be taking photographs of whales so that we can match them to our catalogue and identify individuals using the waters.
I know a little bit about whales and might be able to roughly say what type it is, but to see what an individual is, like how would you go about doing that?
It really varies between the species, and there's only some that you can really tell apart quite easily. Most of them are quite difficult to tell apart. The easy ones are, for example, the humpback whale, you know, our charismatic friend that reaches out into the air and has big long flippers. Now, the undersides of the tail of the humpback whale have distinct markings. So whenever it dives and it turns its tail upwards, that fluke, as we call it, and those undersides have unique patterns on them. So photographs of those are really useful for us because we can identify individuals and the markings don't really change over time. For other whales, for example, the southern right whale, which is our main focus in South Georgia, they have very unique barnacle and sort of unique encrustations and callosities, as we call them, on their heads. They look like big white growths. Now, these patterns are unique for each individual. So if you get a really good picture of a pattern on the head, then you can find that whale again and look for it and see where it's calving and connect it between the feeding ground, which is where we're working at South Georgia, and calving grounds in, for example, Argentina and Brazil. Other whales like the blue whale and the fin whale and the sei whale, they are a lot less clearly marked, but very good quality images of the side of the body and the dorsal fin can be used to match individuals, but they have to be really good quality pictures. So we're really encouraging people to take those good shots if they can. I mean, I know there's people down there with great cameras and any opportunity to get good pictures can potentially get us a unique ID.
So it's a real kind of citizen science project which we're trying to get on board.
It is, and so I should also say, why is this useful? It's because when you know your individuals, then people reporting where and when they've seen them tell us something about how long whales are using those waters for, where they're going when they're calving or breeding. It tells us also how many there are, because the number of times you re-sight the same animal is a proxy for how abundant that whole population is. So if you hardly ever re-sight it, the population is big. But if you're just seeing the same animals again and again, the population's probably quite small. So we can do really useful analysis to understand their numbers using these photos.
I mean, the right whale is called the right whale because it was the right whale to hunt.
Yeah.
So in terms of their recovery, someone said to me that the reason that, you know, South Georgia was the epicenter of modern whaling, and just Cumberland Bay, where King Edward Point, where human habitation is on South Georgia, that bay there, Cumberland Bay, was so full of whales that it took 2 years just to clear the bay. Are the populations showing recovery, and how quickly, or do we know that yet?
So
or is this part of what
you're
trying to find out?
Yeah, that's a big part of what we're trying to do. So yeah, it's quite staggering. They took over 170,000 whales within a day's sailing of South Georgia in the early whaling period. And like you say, the stories about the numbers of whales just using those nearshore waters are just stunning. Nowadays, you don't see anything like those numbers in nearshore waters. And we think it's probably because they're still recovering. So humpback whales, for example, now they're most common in nearshore waters of South Georgia, but they were whaled into the 60s. And so the last estimate of their recovery put them on about 60% recovered for the Southwest Atlantic. So that means that they will still potentially be increasing, and perhaps will get a bit more density when they reach their full carrying capacity, if, you know, 100 years ago represents their carrying capacity. Southern right whales are a different story because they were hunted for about 300 years. So from the 1600s onwards, they were being killed in Brazil, their calving grounds. And so they've been subject to a really, really, really long whaling campaign, and they've been at a really small numbers for at least 150 years. It's probably going to take a lot longer for them to recover. At the moment, the actual aim of our project is to assess their recovery in South Georgia waters and find out how many there are relative to, you know, what we think their carrying capacity might have been in the past. Another thing we need to factor in is that 100 years ago, when the whalers went in there, there were actually very few seals around, because the sealers went in the 19th century. They killed all the fur seals they could find. The fur trade was very valuable. And when the whalers came in the 20th century, in sort of 1904, when Larsen first showed up, I see them in their hundreds and thousands. He was seeing an ecosystem which didn't have fur seals in it, or at least if it did, it was very few. Now, fur seals also feed on Antarctic krill, like the whales. And it is possible that there have been shifts in the system. So when the fur seals were gone 100 years ago, that it might be that the whales were coming in closer to the shore because they could feed on krill without any competition. By competition here, I mean krill swarms are only worth it for whales of a certain size, if those krill swarms are sort of big and dense. And so there's swarms that they will feed on, and swarms that they might choose to bypass. Fur seals, in the huge numbers that exist around South Georgia now, may be having an influence on the size and density of the krill swarms in nearshore waters, which might mean that whales would choose to be further offshore where they get higher density krill swarms. We don't know anything about that. That's entirely a hypothesis. But we're also going to be trying to look at the prey field that the whales are using next year on a bigger survey offshore to try to understand better what the whales are doing when they're in South Georgia, and then think about that in relation to the other species that are also krill feeding.
And the Cosmic Shed likes to bring science and science fiction together. And when you were talking about humpback whales, I was instantly thinking about Star Trek IV, Voyage Home.
Right.
And that anti-whaling film, and it came out in the mid-80s. I was just wondering what your take on that film was.
I didn't watch that. I'm sorry.
So I was like, right, we are going to do a showing of this. I'm going to force Jen to watch it, and then I'm going to see what she thought about it. We've just treated everyone on board the James Clark Ross to a showing of Star Trek IV, A Voyage Home. Now,
Jen, you'd never seen a Star Trek before.
Never had, no.
Are you a convert?
Might have to see a few more before I come back on that.
Okay, so you're not overly impressed by Leonard Nimoy's directorial prowess?
I thought it was quite cute.
So how scientifically accurate was that film?
You know, the whales were pretty accurate. They were the right shape. And the whale calls were good. And I also liked how the whale hung upside down, because that's kind of something that they do. And there's probably a couple of little nuggets in there. Also, I was checking the flute colour to make sure that they had them from the right hemisphere. And it was a light-coloured flute, which is normally associated with the southern hemisphere. But maybe there's a few in the Californian population, I don't know. Normally they're quite dark, their tails in the north.
So there were some people here who were questioning when whaling was kind of when the moratorium happened. So when did that happen?
1986, it fully came into effect. Whales hadn't really been killed for a few years before that, though. I mean, I think 1982 might have been the last catches. I'd have to check.
So 1986, that was the year that they went back to in this film. So some could say that this film potentially caused the stop of whaling.
Could they say that? It's not possible that you're inferring causation from correlation, is it?
No. So I was intrigued that you said that the whales look good, because one of the criticisms about this, which you might interpret this as a bit of an eco-warrior film, one of the biggest criticisms of this film, which I can't personally think of any, but one of the biggest criticisms of it was from animal rights activists who felt that they got too close to the humpbacks and interacted with them too closely. They'd actually made 4 models, and 95% of the footage was from those models, and only 5%.
Yeah, when I said I thought the whales looked good, I meant exactly that they physically looked like good whale images. I think in terms of whether the whole message was good, like you say, it was really of its time. We went through that transition from whaling to let's look after animals in captivity and take care of them to let's absolutely get them out of captivity. And that clearly comes from right at that time when, you know, saving the whales was clearly the idea, was the best way to do that was to put them in zoos before we kind of went against zoos. So, yeah.
Okay.
It's very much of its time, isn't it?
Well, there's a couple of key moments in this film that not many people know about. First of all, this is the only time that this phrase, "Scotty, beam me up," is said in any of Star Trek. Oh, that's a good fact, isn't it? Second fact about this film is when he goes, "Admiral, there be whales here." James Doohan, Scotty, claimed that was his favourite line that Scotty ever said. So this is quite a pinnacle film here. And finally, that iconic scene of the whales going underneath the Bay Bridge, the amazing models, yeah?
I had trouble with that, actually.
Okay, well, the reason you might have had trouble with that is because during that scene, the underwater cable was snagged on a nuclear submarine and they were towed out to sea and they had to recover the models. Your next Star Trek film, what should it be? Anyone? The first one. What?
No, this is the first one.
I've seen. It's the first one you've seen as well?
I've not seen it.
You've not seen any? What?
What?
Okay, this is unbelievable that we're basically a load of science nerds on a boat and very few people have seen any Star Trek. I would recommend First Contact.
First Contact?
Yeah, First Contact. Yeah, go for that one.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. It's got Next Generation, Captain Picard and all that lot. Cool.
How does that happen?
I think the thing about Star Trek is that if you haven't had a parent who's like, "Why don't we watch Star Trek?" It's quite a dense, impenetrable world that you're a bit like, oh God, and you're worried that you're going to be nerdy or become a nerd by watching it. Or you just think, you turn on like partway through an episode and it's just techno babble and you have no idea what the hell is going on. So you dismiss it. And I guess some of those early films know, of the with the original cast might have really appealed to Trekkies, but maybe less so to people who wouldn't identify as sci-fi enthusiasts.
Yeah. Obviously, Discovery's ongoing at the moment. Controversially, I think it's my favourite Star Trek series, Discovery Season 2.
Ooh.
So good. Loving it. We're going to do another episode on that.
So not only did Jen have issues with the humpback whales, but then it turns out that the scene where Chekhov is admitted to the hospital also doesn't stand up to medical scrutiny. So the ship's doctor, Amber Chadwick, had a couple of things to say about that as well.
So, Amber, what didn't you like about the medical scenes in that?
Where to start? It's hard to comment because I wasn't alive in 1986, and perhaps that's what hospitals were like.
How is it different to a modern-day hospital?
Quite a lot different. And I would say that normally patients don't get treated in the corridors, but in the modern NHS, they unfortunately are.
So are you referring to when Dr. McCoy gives that old lady a pill to cure kidney dialysis?
Yes, well, not cure kidney dialysis, probably to cure her kidney failure, she's having dialysis for. But yes, I think she regrew a kidney, which is quite a feat. But
that
who knows? Who knows what the 23rd century is going to hold for us?
I hope that you can just take a tablet and regrow a kidney. Why would you not be able to do that?
I mean, sounds good. What will we die of, though?
Oh, I don't know. So I grew up in the 80s, and I had a big 80s Game Boy, and it had the thing that you clip on the top that had a light and also a magnifying glass on the front of it. So you could play it in bed, and it made everything bigger as well. And that looked a lot like the thing that Dr. McCoy put on Chekhov's head to cure him.
Mm-hmm.
So how likely do you think it is that we'll have a machine that you can just put on someone's head and it fixes their brain?
Well, we do have a machine that some people use at the moment to try and work out which side of the brain an intracranial hemorrhage might be happening in for pre-hospital care, so that you can drill into the correct side of the brain to relieve the pressure. Whether we can develop a machine that doesn't put anything in the brain to repair an artery is quite far away in the future, I think.
Have you ever drilled into anyone's head?
Not an alive person.
You've done it on a dead person?
Yeah, it's what medical school's for.
My God, how many holes did you make?
Is this going out live?
I don't know, they might edit it. Okay. How many holes did you make in a skull?
Well, you practice putting burr holes in, so there's normally like 4 or 6.
Okay, I was just curious. That's fun. And for the untrained medical professional, what actually did Dr. McCoy said that Gillian had as they pushed their way into the operating theatre?
I think he said she's got postprandial upper epigastric distension, which just means she's basically full after food.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you did some social media work on board, and I noticed you seem to discover some sort of mountain.
Yes, so this, I really like this story. I think it was like, you know, you're like, huh? We've got this vertical microstructure profile, a VMP. It costs £250,000. And what you do is you let it go off the back of a boat and it sinks at its own rate. It's not tied to the boat. So you can't insure it because you're like, hi, what are you doing with this instrument? Oh, it costs £250,000. We're just putting it off the back of a boat and it's going to sink to a depth that we want it to, and then it's going to come back up again and we're going to go find it.
Yeah.
Now, the problem with this instrument is it measures like turbulence overturns and shear every centimetre. And so you imagine every centimetre going down 5,000 metres. It's quite impressive, a lot of data, and the sensors at the end of it, it's got a whole load of them, and they're basically really, really, really fragile little vibrating wires or little glass bubbles. So if you get the depth wrong and you plough those sensors into the seabed, each one of those sensors costs $7,000.
Yeah.
And so there's like 6 of them on there. So it's a lot of money if you do that. So you've got to get the depth of it just right. So we're in the middle of this area called the Discovery Bank, and you look on the chart and people haven't been there for ages. The depths that we've got on the chart there were in fathoms to start off with, and they were probably taken Victorian times with a guy with a, you know, a rope and a lump of lead tied to the bottom of it. So we had a couple of depths. So as we're going along the whole survey, we're firing sound into the water. We're using this thing called a multi-beam, which does a big fan of sound, and we're logging and mapping the seabed as we go. Really, really, like, we can do it to the, like, a meter resolution. So it's really cool. Mm-hmm. And then the data we get, we then give back to the hydrographic office, who then use it to improve their maps. So we're going along in this area, and we thought we had like 4,000 meters of water. And so we're like trying to plan the next VMP release to make sure it doesn't, we get the right depth so it doesn't go into the seabed. And we're like, oh, what depth are we at? And we look over at this the console that has all the depth data coming in. And we're like, oh, whoa, look, that's cool. We're like driving along a marine canyon. How cool is that? And it looked really, like, really sci-fi, like this, with this multicoloured trench as we're going along it. And then as we're looking at the trench, we notice that it starts getting shallower and shallower. So it's like blue is deep, and then yellow is getting shallower, then red is super shallow. Mm-hmm. And we're getting shallower and shallower. And then in about 30 seconds, we'd gone from 4,000 metres to 1,000 metres. And we were like, whoa, like, that's quite... And then we kept looking at it, and then it was like 200 metres. And then someone went, do you think we should let the bridge know? And we were like, yeah, OK. So we phoned the bridge. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. And we were like, you know, we've only got 100 metres of water underneath us. And the guy was like, no, according to our sensor, we've got 4,000. And up on the bridge, they primarily use the single beam one. It's got a little bit of a lag time. And we were like, definitely got 100 metres. And so it was like, what? All stop, middle of the night, woke up the captain. And then as we, while the quick stop everything going on, it had got even shallower. And it had come up to like 40 metres, which is insane. When you were expecting 4,000 metres, yeah. And in 2 minutes, it had gone from 4,000 metres to 40 metres.
Yeah. Wow.
So we basically discovered something... The size of the Alps in the middle of nowhere, just this big seamount, this like giant wall underwater. And, you know, we had to go forward slowly because it was an unsurveyed area and there was a chance that we could, scrape the bottom of the boat. We didn't know how shallow it was going to get. So I was like, that's really cool. Like, on this earth that we think, oh yeah, we've surveyed everything, we've explored everything, oh, this is great. We occasionally find a new beast in the ocean, but to find like an Alp underwater and accidentally or potentially have like clipped your boat on it was quite exciting.
Amazing.
So I stuck a thing on Twitter about it, and I was on the night shift, went to bed, woke up, and all these people are like, whoa, you just go down the water mountain, that's awesome. And all these people wanting to like do a press release about it. And so we were joking about, oh, what should we call it? So we were like, well, maybe we should call it after the lead scientist and call it like Mount Brearley. And we're like, oh, that's good. And then we were like, well, hold on. Who's the guy in charge of the night shift? And that was a guy called David Betts. We were like, let's call it the Bet Bump. And then this other guy was like, actually, we should name it after everyone on the night shift. So he wrote down, like, everyone's names, like, you know, Tom, Will, Andreas, all this, and tried to come up with an acronym. And noticed that we only had one A. So he was like, can we instead of using Russell, can we use Arnott? And I was like, yeah. And so he came up with this acronym, TwatPad. So it ended up being called Mount TwatPad, which I really, really love. And I really hope that gets put on like an official UK Hydrographic Office chart. Just like Mount TwatPad. Like,
and so what happens from that now? I mean, does that just stay there and then it's sort of logged somewhere and then other people might go and survey it again and confirm it as a discovery or what?
Yeah, well, so all the data that we've been logging needs to be, you know, QC'd and, you know, they need to go through it. And we literally just drove over the top of it because our job there wasn't to survey the ocean bed. We were just doing it as like an aside. Mm. So I guess if there is some funding available and there's a proper hydrographic team on board, then they'll come along and they will survey it properly. Unfortunately, these things aren't that rare in the ocean, especially around the Southern Ocean, especially the Southern Pacific Ocean, because hardly any boats go there. It's actually mapped in very, very poor resolution, a lot of it. Mm. So we're used to being like, oh yeah, we mapped the seabed, And we have to a degree, but it's like each pixel is the size of a football pitch. Now we're at the stage where each pixel can be the size of a football.
Cool. The famous phrase from the original Blue Planet series, we know more about the surface of the moon than we know about the what's underneath our ocean. We're getting to know more about it.
We have three missions. So first of all, we had to go to the Orkney Passage, and we had a load of deep sea moorings that have been down there for a year or so. They've got velocity meters on there, temperature sensors, conductivity sensors to measure salinity and stuff like that. And they're really cool, and you chuck them off the back of a boat with a big train wheel attached to them that weighs about half a ton.
Literally a train wheel?
Actually a train wheel. Oh. In between all the expensive sensors and the train wheel, there's a thing called an acoustic release. So all of the sensors, and there's like various like little buoys or buoys keeping the sensors in a nice vertical alignment, and you go along and you have a hydrophone and you fire a signal into the sea, and each there's a little thing, the acoustic release is trained to listen out for its particular signal, and then it turns and it releases, and the train wheel stays on the bottom of the ocean and all the expensive sensors float to the top. Mm-hmm. Which is quite cool.
Yeah.
And the train wheel's just iron, so it rusts away and goes back to its original form, so it's non-polluting and things. And you bring up all the sensors, clean them, download the data, then put them back down again. So we had 100% success rate at recovering. Cool. And redeploying all our moorings, which was really nice. As well as that, we had this vertical microstructure profiler to get an idea of the turbulence as we're going in and out of this this Orkney Passage. And we had these amazing gliders called Slocum gliders. They're basically tiny robots, and you program them with what you want to do. You put them in this ocean, and they go fly down to a certain depth, recording stuff as they go. Then they swoop back up to the surface. They stick their butt out, and they send all their data to a satellite, and it arrives on your computer.
Wow.
And then 3 months later, once it's had enough or run out of battery, floats to the top, flashes away, and you send a boat out to go pick it up. We are currently in the middle of the Southern Ocean, heading somewhere. I think it's called the Orkney Passage, and we are with someone from the British Antarctic Survey.
Hi, my name's Ryan. I'm a third year PhD student at the British Antarctic Survey. My PhD is using these underwater gliders.
It looks like an amazing piece of kit. It's like a yellow torpedo.
It may look like a torpedo, but it's actually a scientific instrument. And so you can see here we have to write scientific instrument in big letters, and so that anyone that sees it in the ocean can see that it isn't a torpedo. But yeah, so what it does is it measures several different things. You can customise the sensors you put on there. But the standard thing that it measures is how hot and salty the ocean is. So it's temperature and salinity. And then it can measure other things like the oxygen content of the ocean, the amount of chlorophyll in the ocean.
So the chlorophyll is the compound that is in phytoplankton?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
Yeah. And then some of them have this big tube on the top, a microstructure sensor.
Ooh.
Which basically all that means is it measures small scale changes in temperature and also shear.
So when you say microscale,
like, it's a centimetre scale.
So every centimetre. Yeah. Okay, so it's like really, really high precision.
And,
okay.
Yeah, and that's important because it's at that smaller scale that transfer in heat starts to happen.
Why are we interested in heat transfer?
Particularly in the Southern Ocean, we wanted to understand how this heat is getting transferred from the warmer parts of the ocean down to the base of the ice shelves. Because it's the ocean that's causing this melting of the ice shelves. Yeah.
And so once you've got that data, you then can give that to climate modeler.
Yeah.
Who can then put those values in and make their model better so they can mm-hmm. predict how the climate is going to be in the future.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
So it's on an autonomous vehicle.
Uh-huh.
And what that means is that we can leave it out in the ocean for typically 2 or 3 months, but sometimes up to 6 months.
Wow.
And we can pilot it from anywhere in the world on our laptop. As soon as it goes under the water, you lose all communications with it.
Okay.
So you're kind of hoping it's doing what you tell it, what you've told it to do.
Okay.
But you can tell it new like waypoints to go and places to go.
That's amazing. So it's effectively like a robot torpedo spaceship underwater submarine that you
yeah.
put over the back of a boat and then just leave it to its own devices and
you check on it. You check on it.
Okay. Yeah. And so it pops up occasionally,
mm-hmm.
and sends you some data. You send it some new instructions.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
So the ones we have here go down to a maximum of about 1,000 meters.
Okay. At that depth, there would be, let me get this right, 100 kilos on every square centimeter of area on this thing. Which, if a human went down that deep, we'd be crushed into nothing.
Exactly.
So the fact that this thing can tolerate those depths is pretty impressive.
Yeah, yeah. Sure. Yeah, definitely.
So how do you get it back then? You just go arrange to meet it somewhere, or?
Yeah. So every time it's at the surface, it tells us where it is, and so what we typically do is deploy it on one cruise, and then another cruise in a couple of months' time will come and pick it up. And the way that that happens is, well, one of two ways, really. One, you can just tell it to stay at the surface, and then you can basically try and grab it with a big net. And then some of them have a thing here, and this is called a recovery nose. And what happens is this fires off, and this cable stretches between this and the glider, and then this can take the whole weight of the glider.
Right.
So you can basically, it makes it a lot easier to grab hold of this with a crane and then just lift it up and put it onto the deck.
Okay, that's quite impressive, because although these things don't look heavy, they are completely chock full of sensors and batteries and oil. To be honest, we just to get this on the bench took three of us.
Yeah.
So they are seriously heavy beasts. So the fact that that little yellow cable can support the whole weight.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Is pretty impressive.
You've discovered mountains. We've got a muscly guy cradling a with a lovely moustache, cradling a baby dolphin.
Victorian strongman.
I stepped into the shed this morning, not knowing what was going to happen, and you stepped onto that boat, not knowing what was going to happen. Do you think you'd do something like this again?
I'm very aware that my experience on board was atypical and that this kind of stuff doesn't normally happen. The boat itself was really plush. The chef on board was awesome. We got three-course meals a day. We had, you know, we ate in a lounge with our own personalised napkin rings and things like that. And, you know, there's two bars, there's a gym, you know, cinema and all this. But being stuck on a boat, you know, that's 90 metres long for 6 weeks, doing 12 hours on, 12 hours off night shift, was actually quite hard work. And about 3-4 weeks in, where you're like, I've still got another 2 weeks, like, you felt very trapped on board the boat. And you get up and you are taking measurements in the deep ocean, so you're just there staring at a screen, watching data coming in. And then you do that for 12 hours. And then you eat, go to sleep, and the cycle repeats. Mm. And you don't, there's not like a weekend or anything like that, so you don't get time off. And because of all the things that happened, like, we ended up having to cut a section out of our survey where we would have just been taking like deep sea measurement, just constantly of just like temperature, salinity all the way along. And that would have been quite monotonous, I think. I mean, I feel like, oh, wow, I was on board for 6 weeks. I mean, the actual crew that run the boat, they do 3 months on, 3 months off.
Yeah.
And being on there for 3 months, it's like, you know, you can understand why sailors let their hair down when they get into port, kind of thing.
Yeah.
This idea that when scientists go and do field work, it's like a big jolly.
Hmm.
Or like, oh, yeah, oh, I just pratting about. And it was a lot of hard work, and there's a lot of data processing, and the kind of jobs where you have to keep your brain active enough to make sure you don't make a mistake, but it's not like really tantalising. Yeah.
So we're going to be the two of us at Blue Dot Festival this summer. Well, it's probably be more than just us two, because it's actually happening on the weekend, the 50th anniversary weekend of the Apollo 11 moon landing. So I'm going to be there with Tom Adams doing our show The Lesser Sun, which is a comedy lecture about the 400,000 people that NASA estimates it took to get humanity to the moon. What are you doing there?
So I also work with a marine education charity called Incredible Oceans, and we have got a giant inflatable ocean dome which is full of life-size inflatable whales, sharks, dolphins, seals, loads of cool artifacts where people can kind of come and pick them up and hold them and do a bit of a show and tell about those. So we've got things like, you know, dolphin skulls and whale teeth and things like that. But I really love ocean exploration. I really love space exploration. So I'm also giving a talk there called Exploring the Deep, Ocean versus Space, where we see which is the hardest environment to visit.
Okay. I'll come along to the talk.
Yeah.
Wonderful stuff. So thank you very much for joining me here in the Cosmic Shed. I'm sure you'll be back again soon enough.
Thanks for having us in.
No worries. And thank you very much for listening.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.
This podcast is brought to you by the Stimulus Network.